This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear more from candidates running to represent the Central Coast in state and federal government.
Having another relief package basically on the books is something that needs to be done ASAP.
Also, this week is Media Literacy Week in the U.S. and around the world.
We define media literacy as the ability to access, analyze, evaluate, create, and act using all forms of communication.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, October 26th, 2020. I'm Carol Tangeman. The city of Santa Maria has grown considerably in the last two decades. With more than 100,000 residents, it is the largest city both in population and geographic area in Santa Barbara County. This election, Santa Maria voters are deciding who will be the city's mayor for the next 4 years, Beth Thornton reports.
The Santa Maria mayor's race has three candidates, incumbent Mayor Alice Patino and two challengers, Will Smith and Alberto Ugalde. Patino is a longtime Santa Marian who is seeking her third term as mayor. Prior to being the first woman elected as the city's mayor in 2012, she served on the city council and multiple boards. Patino describes herself as pro-business, and she also says her philosophy about spending is straightforward.
I feel that government needs to only spend the money that we are given. We have to live within our means.
If reelected, Patino has a list of priorities for the next 4 years.
I think one priority and is very important to me and very important to the community is to continue to support our police and our fire.
And if Santa Maria wants to attract new businesses, she says, additional housing is essential.
And we need housing from low income, moderate income, and above moderate income. We need all kinds of housing here. We don't have enough housing.
Patino credits her willingness to listen to constituents as a big part of her success thus far. The mayor position, she says, is nonpartisan, and she works to represent all community members, whether they vote for her or not. The Santa Barbara County Republican Party supports her reelection, as do the Santa Maria Police Officers Association and Southwest Regional Council of Carpenters. Will Smith ran against Patino in 2016. He says he's better prepared this time as a candidate. He knows what to expect and has fine-tuned his message. He talks about beautifying the city, creating soccer fields and other activities for younger generations.
We want our city to look beautiful. Not only do we want it to look nice that people feel safe when they come here.
Smith worked in education in the past and now describes himself as an author and minister. In 2010, he was elected to the Santa Maria Bonita School Board.
First ever elected African-American in the city of Santa Maria, and I've got an extensive background doing a variety of other things.
Smith is not shy about expressing his views and cites his past push for bilingual education and school retrofits as evidence of getting the job done. He says past conflicts with elected officials will not get in his way of bringing people together if elected.
When you're invoking change, a lot of people don't like it, especially when they have been in institutionalized systems. And I believe that is a large part of Santa Maria in a lot of the areas. Not only has there not been great diversity, it's just a few people that have been in spots for years.
Alberto Ugalde is a small business owner and first-time candidate. He's 30 years old and has owned a barbershop for 5 years, often giving free haircuts to students and veterans. He talks to local residents while he works and sees a need for improved communication between elected officials and the business community.
Better communication between the small business owners and pretty much not just the business owners, but everybody within our community. So they have the reassurance that we're doing everything we possibly can to pull through this pandemic.
He says public safety issues like additional streetlights and flashing pedestrian crosswalks are needed in Santa Maria.
Small things like that our city could do to so our residents feel safe.
Ugalde has spent much of the campaign introducing himself and educating people on the need to vote and make their voices heard. He says it's important for people to get involved in their communities.
When it comes to local elections, we got to put our differences aside and come together so we could solve the issues in our community. because at the end of the day, we're all San Marians.
For KCBX, I'm Beth Thornton reporting in Santa Barbara County.
Continuing KCBX's election coverage, last week we heard from Don Addis, one of the candidates vying to represent the Central Coast in the State Assembly. This week we speak with incumbent Jordan Cunningham, allowing each candidate equal time. The San Luis Obispo Tribune has provided comprehensive coverage of the race for the 35th State Assembly District, fact-checking claims by both candidates and looking at their records and positions. On October 22nd, the Tribune's editorial board endorsed Cunningham with reservations. In this conversation, KCBX's Greta Mart follows up on the Tribune's look at concerns about Cunningham's voting record, starting with Cunningham's no vote on SB 276, the school vaccine law written in response to allegations that doctors were writing fraudulent exemptions.
That was probably the toughest vote in terms of figuring out where my district was at and figuring out what the right vote was on policy. I'd say it's one of the hardest ones I've had. And I actually met with probably well over 100 constituents. I met with doctors. I researched it. I'm very pro-vaccine as a personal matter. I think vaccinations are important. What the law did a number of years ago was they eliminated the personal belief exemption for vaccines and moved it to a medical-based exemption. What this bill, SB 276, would have did, because it was passed and signed, is it eliminated the medical exemption. And instead of the doctor making the determination that it might not be right for a particular kid to have certain vaccines at a certain time, that would be subject to the oversight and review of a board and of a bureaucracy within the Department of Public Health. And because I strongly believe that doctors should be making the decisions on medical issues in consultation with their patients and in their patients' best interest for their health, I did not end up supporting that bill. I thought the law as it was adequate, and it struck the right balance between vaccinations and, you know, achieving that public good, but also letting the doctors make the decisions on a medical basis for their patient.
How about the next one, AB 424, which deals with guns in schools? Can you talk about your decision-making process on that one?
Yeah, it's already California law that you can't have guns within 1,000 feet of schools. That's been the law for a long time. That's appropriate, of course. Before 424 was enacted, a particular school district, if it so chose, could petition for an exemption to that so that if they wanted to have, say, a former law enforcement officer who had a concealed carry permit and, you know, had a career of 25 or 30 years of safely handling a firearm. If a school district felt like, you know, maybe on a temporary basis, they wanted to have a former law enforcement officer be able to carry near a school for security reasons, they could get that exemption. And what 424 did is eliminate that exemption. And I thought it wasn't necessary to do that. It's California law. You can't have guns within 1,000 feet of schools, and I think that's totally fine. I support that.
Okay, got it. And how about the last one that the Tribune brings up in this article? SB 320 requires public university health centers to stock abortion medication, but only if it's funded by private contributions.
Yeah, that was a tough vote. You know, generally, I think that there were some concerns raised that there would be public funds used potentially to subsidize that. You know, I think general as a general matter, and, you know, I should note, too, I support it keeps being raised in this campaign that I don't support Planned Parenthood. I got a 66% vote rating from Planned Parenthood. I support 97% of what Planned Parenthood does. It's important for contraception access. They do a lot of work for people's health, and all those things are supportable. I have not in my public career supported public funds being used for abortion. And that's where I've always drawn the line. I've been very upfront with voters about that. And, you know, some people on the right don't like that I support a lot of what Planned Parenthood does. Some people more on the left don't like that I draw the line there. But I think that's a pretty reasonable position to be in. And I thought that that particular bill had the potential to disturb that balance.
Can you just elaborate for our listeners the issues they raise about you not commenting on federal politics? Can you just get into that a little bit?
Well, first of all, that isn't accurate. I have written public letters and commented publicly many times when our federal policies, when I felt that they encroached on California's right to make certain determinations that should be left to California, particularly in the environmental area. I spoke out publicly against opening up the Carrizo Plains National Monument to more oil drilling. I have spoken out and written letters opposing the expansion of offshore oil drilling off our coasts. I have called out the administration in fact, I co-authored a resolution calling out the administration when it wanted to not grant California the waiver that every president since Nixon had granted California to set its own auto emission standards. We have more cars in California than anywhere. When I was a kid going to LA, you could barely see in the afternoon because of all the smog. We've been able to clean that up in a tremendous way because we got those waivers and we were able to implement our own standards that are a little bit higher. And it's natural that a state with mountains and basins and valleys like ours that has the most cars should be able to set a little bit a stricter standard on auto emissions. So where the federal administration or the federal government or Congress has encroached, in my view, on what should be California's ability to govern our own affairs, I haven't been shy about calling that out. What I will not do is pontificate on every federal issue that comes around. I don't think the voters hired me to do that. They hired me to make good laws, to advance our region, to get things done in infrastructure investment on the Central Coast, which we've done a tremendous job of in 4 years. They didn't hire me to be like an armchair pundit and criticize the president or criticize Congress. I'm not in the federal government. That isn't the job they hired me to do.
Can you just speak briefly on the Tribune's beef with you about the conducting negative campaigns?
Well, I'd say, look, there's elections. Elections require informing the voters about your opponent's policy positions. I mean, I think there's a difference between so-called negative campaigning, where you're telling voters what your opponent's record in office has been, how they've voted, what their public statements have been. For instance, you know, my opponent has voted for numerous tax and fee increases on the city council, supported increasing garbage collection rates 20% in a pandemic when people are struggling to get by. So my job as a candidate is to inform people about those things so that they have all the information they need to select who they would like to represent them in state government. That's one thing, and I think that's a legitimate function of a campaign. It's another thing to go very, very personal and start attacking somebody's character, or you know, implying that they don't show up for work, or that they don't with totally misleading and false claims and that don't have any backing. And I have not done that. I have not criticized my opponent's character in any way, shape, or form. Every one of the ads I have run is based on her public record while on the city council and her public statements while as a candidate for the assembly, and it's all about policy, and that's totally appropriate, and that's what campaigns need to do.
That was 35th District State Assembly incumbent Jordan Cunningham speaking with KCBX's Greta Mart. You can hear more of KCBX's interview with Cunningham and Addis at kcbx.org. California's 20th congressional district includes Salinas and the entire Salinas Valley. Congressman Jimmy Panetta is one of the candidates running for the seat as the incumbent Democrat. He's undefeated and running for his third term in the House of Representatives. KAZU's Michelle Loxton has this interview.
Congressman, if elected, what will your work be like if Donald Trump wins re-election?
Oh, look, I've been dealing with this for the past 3.5 years, okay? It's continuing to obviously push back against this administration, which we have been doing a number of ways, not just out there politically, but professionally and policy-wise. But at the same time, it's continuing to work for why I'm there in Washington, D.C., to fight for the values of the people of the Central Coast. And I think we've done a pretty good job at that, to be frank, despite having Donald Trump in this administration. But let's not think about that. Let's talk about having a Biden-Harris administration and how much will get done, not just here on the Central Coast, but throughout this country, if the people play their part and participate in this upcoming election.
Well, that's actually my follow-up question is, how will your work be different if Joe Biden wins?
Look, when I think about having a President Joe Biden and a Vice President Harris, I can't help but smile because you can only imagine what we've been dealing with back there in Washington, D.C. 117th Congress with a Biden-Harris administration will be very productive, and not just introducing legislation, not just laying the foundation with legislation like we have been in the last 2 years, but actually getting it signed into law. Having another relief package basically on the books is something that needs to be done ASAP. We're going to focus on climate change, making sure that we cut our carbon by 2050, 100%. We're going to work on immigration reform, also dealing with affordable housing. I think we need to look at a Renters Relief Act to ensure that people get a federal tax deduction if they have to pay more than one third of the income for housing is very important. And then it's making sure that we close the inequality gap that has expanded so much under President Trump. And we can do that by focusing on education, focusing on healthcare, focusing on housing, focusing on a $15 minimum wage. We need to revisit and reverse the 2017 tax law that was passed under President Trump. Gun safety reform is another issue. 90% of the American people agree that universal background checks is something we can do. Of course, we passed that in the House of Representatives. If there's a Biden-Harris administration, we'll get it done this coming Congress.
So how will you reach out to members of the opposing party to work together on issues and attempt to find compromise?
I've made it clear that I will work with anybody that will benefit the people of the Central Coast. And so I have laid that foundation through my work on certain caucuses, the Problem Solvers Caucus, through my work in legislation, the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, in which Democrats and Republicans, farmers and farm workers, were at the table for 9 months grinding away on legislation. And what you realize is that this job is about relationships. This job is about what relationships are built on, and that's trust.
So why does the Monterey Bay and beyond need you representing them in the House rather than your opponent, Jeff Gorman?
Look, I think now more than ever, government needs to work for people. And I think if you're in public office, it's our obligation to make government work for people. There's so much unpredictability going on. There's so much uncertainty right now. People are very unnerved right now. And the least that we can do is live up to our obligation to make government work for people. And I believe that I've provided that. Looking at the last relief package, how much money was brought in to the Central Coast? Look at the wildfires that we've had to experience. Basically, it was my work and advocacy which allowed the federal government to determine to make the major disaster declarations to then allow FEMA relief to come into Santa Cruz counties and Monterey counties. We help people on the Central Coast, and I believe that people will understand that and appreciate that, and that's why they'll send me back to Washington, D.C. to continue to fight for them.
So if I could ask you to choose three words that you think describe the things or the issues that are most important to residents in this district, which would those words be?
Climate, housing, immigration.
And I wanted to finish off now with talking about a number of the key issues this country and California has faced in recent months and how you'd rate the response. Let's start with the coronavirus pandemic. How do you think this has been handled?
Look, I think at it from a national perspective and looking at the administration, I think absolutely failed. There has not been a national, unified, singular strategy. But I believe that people in lower levels of government have stepped up and instituted a strategy that is federally funded, state mandated, and locally executed. And when it comes to federally funded, we've lived up to our role. $2.2 trillion, the largest relief package in the CARES Act, basically allowing funding to come into our districts, over $1.4 billion into the Central Coast. And then obviously making sure that there's another relief package. You hear the chair of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, basically say that if nothing's done in regards to a relief package, there's going to be tragic results. Federal government has the resources to do that. The Federal Reserve Bank has lowered the interest rates for us to do that. So now more than ever, it needs to be done. That's why we passed the HEROES Act back in May. That's why I hope that leadership continues to push forward and pass another relief package, because that's what's needed right now to get us through this health and economic tragedy that we're going through.
And what about Black Lives Matter and policing? How do we build more trust between minority communities and the police?
Yeah, look, I think we all understand that Black Lives Matter, but it's also making sure that we turn those words into deeds. And we did that in Congress. We passed the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, a bill that will revamp the legal standards for prosecuting police misconduct. It creates a national database to track police misconduct, and it focuses on police training to de-escalate force rather than use of force. And that's a first step. Just a first step in getting that passed to make sure that we deal not just with Black Lives Matter, but we understand systemic racism and how it affects, and that we need to stop that in all of our systems of government.
And finally, I wanted to ask you about wildfires. So homes have been destroyed, tens of thousands have been evacuated, our air quality has been horrid in recent days. Our future looks like one where we have to coexist with fire. How do you think California should be approaching this ongoing challenge?
Let me make it clear. This is not a binary choice. It's not just about dealing with the climate crisis or dealing with our federal forests. We can do both. And that's why I've put forward legislation to deal with both. Obviously, we understand that it's hotter, it's drier, our forests are more vulnerable to wildfires. Looking at what's going on in Louisiana right now, you're seeing these hurricanes that are bigger, stronger and lasting longer. So something needs to be done at the climate level. There's no silver bullet, but it's way beyond time that we start loading and firing our legislative gun to dealing with the climate crisis. It's exactly why I introduced the Climate Action Rebate Plan that cuts carbon output by 50% by 2030 and then 100% by 2050. It's why I put forward legislation like the Wildfire Public Safety Act, which allows us to go into federal forests and reasonably remove all the dead fuels that are there, making our forests so vulnerable and susceptible to those dry lightning strikes that are coming through and sparking those fires. But it's also about reforestation projects. There's a backlog right now of reforestation projects that go in and replant trees after wildfires. We need to provide more funding for those projects, which my bill, the Replant Act, does. And then I'm going to be introducing a bill in the next 2 weeks that allows for more funding for federal workers in the Federal Forest Service to ensure that basically we're not just there to suppress fires, we're there to prevent fires.
That was incumbent Congressman Jimmy Panetta speaking with KAZU. This is Media Literacy Week in the U.S. and around the world. Contributor Beth Thornton talks with the executive director of a nonprofit organization that hosts a week-long event to highlight media literacy education.
This is Michelle Chula Lipkin, and I am the executive director of the National Association for Media Literacy Education.
And I'm so happy to talk with you, especially as Media Literacy Week is kicking off all around the country. Let's get started with a definition of media literacy so it's clear what we're talking about.
I always love starting there. So namely, my organization, that's what we call ourselves, we define media literacy as the ability to access, analyze, evaluate, create, and act using all forms of communication. So in simplest terms, it's an expanded definition of literacy for the modern age when media is so prevalent in so many forms.
What is it about our current media landscape that requires these new literacy skills?
Well, I think that if you think about the importance of traditional literacy when, you know, the written word and the printed word became robust and kind of universal, that is kind of the situation that we are in now when we have all of these tools and all of these communication tools that we need to really understand how to consume and author and read and write. You know, if you think of all media text as what used to be just print text, we really do need to understand how to be a consumer of the information and also a creator of the information. And media literacy right now is that much more important because we have entered a stage in human history where we are living in a participatory culture. So we see everyone, individuals who are, you know, negotiating media on social media platforms, on YouTube, on text messaging, you know, we are all navigating this and we're all creators. We're all participating in this environment. And so it's that much more important to make sure that we are truly literate in these tools. And the just complete unbelievable vast amount of information that is out there and the speed in which that information gets spread really means that these skills that we talk about when we talk about media literacy are more important than ever. And in a lot of ways at this point, they're not only essential, but urgent. We really, really need to make sure that people have these skills so we can navigate in a healthy and responsible way through the media landscape.
The National Association for Media Literacy Education, your organization, what are the goals and what is the mission of the organization?
The mission of NAMELY is to make sure media literacy is highly valued and widely practiced as an essential life skill. So really what we are looking at is amplifying media literacy educations across the U.S. and also beyond. We are a nonprofit membership organization, and it's a free membership for individuals. And our membership, interestingly enough, while it's about two-thirds U.S.-based, we have a lot. The other one-third is global. And we're really focused on the U.S., but it even goes beyond the U.S. The ultimate goal is ensuring that media literacy is taught from the very youngest age to really through life, because it really is an ongoing skill. But if you think about formal education, the really earliest ages to graduation, that students are getting the media literacy skill building that they need.
What percentage of members are teachers and librarians versus maybe media and technology people?
The great majority of the people within our community are people that are practicing media literacy in some way. We certainly have media makers, we have journalists, we have advocates, you know, people that are really just passionate about media literacy. But most of our services and the things that we organize are geared toward educators.
And I read on your website that you've gone from 300 to 5,000 members in the last 5 years. Is that right?
So when we made a decision to go to free membership, that was in 2016. And that happened after actually the first US Media Literacy Week, when we realized there was so much interest in this work, yet our membership numbers were really low. And so in 2016, when we went to a free membership model, we did grow from 300 to about 3,500 members in like the course of 4 months. It was amazing. And now we're at about 6,000 members and really growing, like not even joking, growing every single day. And now we're hoping with US Media Literacy Week right before the presidential election that we're gonna see those numbers grow and really get more people involved in the media literacy community.
This is a conversation with Michelle Chulalipkin from the National Association for Media Literacy Education. And National Media Literacy Week is October 26th through 30th. What is the purpose of Media Literacy Week and how does it work?
We were inspired by our Canadian neighbors for quite some time. Canada and the work of the Canadian Federation of Teachers and our wonderful partners at Media Smarts have been doing Media Literacy Week in Canada. It's got to be up to 15 years at this point. And really one of the questions that I got a lot when I started at NAMELY, which was in 2012, was, you know, when is the US going to do our own Media Literacy Week, or when are we going to at least support the efforts? And so in 2015, we launched Media Literacy Week, and it was really an attempt to highlight the work of media literacy education around the country and also build a annual event that the media literacy community could be involved with. And the thinking with the Media Literacy Week that it would really be a grassroots effort, that while Namely would quote unquote host it, what we were hoping is that our community and beyond our community, people would have events, would do screenings and panel discussions, do education, or use educational materials around media literacy in their classroom. And so over the years, we've built what has been just a growing initiative. And this year, obviously, is different because it is all virtual. But because of it being all virtual, we actually have a lot more events planned. And we also see a lot of organizations and members really participating. And what's really exciting about it is that while we are definitely seeing a lot of conversation about the election in terms of media literacy, specifically combating misinformation and disinformation, we are also seeing a lot of people exploring the broader concepts of media literacy. And we have a few events actually that I'm really excited about that look at representation in film and TV and really dive into those issues. So really the focus of Media Literacy Week is once again to amplify the work of the media literacy community and to create opportunities to expand that community and educate more people so that they understand the importance of media literacy education and can help us kind of move it forward in the U.S.
Is your organization actually sponsoring events that people can log onto?
Yeah, all of our events are free. So we, if you go to the Media Literacy Week website, which is medialiteracyweek.us, we have an events tab and an events list, and we are doing events every single day. We have a really exciting kickoff event with Thomson Reuters on October 26th at 11 a.m. Eastern, in which we're talking about the intersection of journalism and fact-checking and media literacy. We have evening events where we're highlighting two Netflix films. One is called The Claudia Kishi Club, which is about the Asian American character in the Babysitter's Club books. And we're having conversation with the director and cast members about Asian American representation. And then one of the most exciting events is on Thursday, the 29th, we're doing a conversation with the filmmakers of Disclosure, which is a film about transgender representation in film and television. And then we have a closing event with our partners at PBS NewsHour and Circle, also doing an event around Amazon Prime's All In, The Fight for Democracy, which is a film about voter suppression and features Stacey Abrams. So a lot of really interesting events. And again, because of COVID and because of the virtual nature of this initiative, the bright side is that we were able to plan a lot more events with a lot more variety and diversity because we weren't thinking about in-person events. It's really turning into just an incredible initiative where people from all over the globe are getting involved. It's been incredible to watch it grow.
And will you be posting some of the presentations on your website? If people miss them during the actual Media Literacy Week, will they be accessible at a later date?
Likely most. I don't know if we'll be doing all of them. There's some permission that we might not get granted, but with a lot of the educational ones, like the webinars with around curriculum and PD, those will be able to be accessed after.
Okay, well, that's a great transition to my next question, which is that given so much of education right now is virtual and online, what tips do you have for individuals, maybe especially parents?
I would say that in this age of kind of information overload, really the most important thing that we can be thinking about is honing our inquiry skills, which in simplest terms is learning how to ask questions and really, really focusing on being skeptical about all the media that we consume, everything we see, hear, and read in a way that is not cynical, right? One of the things we don't want to see is we don't want to see a world that doesn't believe anything, just like we don't want a world of people that believe everything. We want to be somewhere in between. So I think what's really important, whether you are watching the news or a documentary or on your social media feeds, that you ask yourselves questions about what you're consuming and certainly what you decide to share. And certainly making sure that you take the time to think and process and ask questions before sharing or before kind of making your own conclusions about topics. The fact that we are surrounded by media all the time, but the fact that digital tools right now are that much more important because of our kind of lockdown mentality with COVID, and that's relevant across the globe. Even tools that are allowing us to connect like FaceTime and texting, like really being reflective and, you know, learning a lot about your own habits and your own beliefs and your own bias is really important to think about, especially when we're just surrounded by media content all the time.
That was Executive Director Michelle Chulalipkin. Find more information at namely.net. This is Beth Thornton for Issues and Ideas.
The performing arts industry is taking a huge hit during the COVID-19 crisis without much direction for an eventual reopening. For the KCBX Arts Beat, Rachel Showalter reports on steps being taken by industry leaders in San Luis Obispo County.
For many businesses right now, the income is dried up, employees are taking pay cuts, and the future remains uncertain as doors stay shut. In an attempt to light the way for the industry, local arts administrators are taking action. The Central Coast Coalition of Arts Leaders recently reached out to the state and San Luis Obispo County Health Departments with the goal of prioritizing the industry's reopening.
We all thought we'd be back by now. Chris Miller was all ready for full steam ahead on January 1st, right?
That's right. I've still got you on the calendar.
That's San Luis Obispo Symphony Executive Director Anna James Miller and Chris Miller, Managing Director of the Performing Arts Center San Luis Obispo. The two are unrelated, and they're talking about a symphony show that was scheduled at the Performing Arts Center. They're among 38 local coalition leaders to have signed and sent a letter addressing concerns over a lack of industry-specific reopening guidelines. Coalition members say until recently, the performing arts had been left out of the public health discussion, and they say the negative economic impact to their industry is snowballing.
We ended our fiscal year at the end of June with a $140,000 deficit because of the canceled events. We immediately went to more than a 50% reduction of the budget on July 1st. So we're now on about a $580,000 budget for the current year. And had we not done that, we already would have closed our doors. It makes me concerned about whether we'll be able to have any kind of season at all next year.
Anna James Miller says since the pandemic began, the symphony has tried to schedule several different events with safety protocols in place. Miller says requests for plans that included live performances, even with no audience or in outdoor venues, were denied by public health officials. The San Luis Obispo County Public Health Department says officials understand the challenges businesses face right now, but also says in many ways the department's hands are tied until further documentation is provided at the state level. In a statement to KCBX, the Public Health Department says, quote, "In the absence of further state guidance regarding live in-person performances, we strongly encourage the Central Coast Coalition of Arts Leaders to continue performing virtually. We also recommend the coalition continue to advocate directly with leaders at the state level to have your industry's operations addressed in future state guidelines," end quote. And the wheels are being set in motion. Earlier this month, the governor's office announced that recording live performances without an audience is allowed unless an individual county prohibits it. Coalition members say this will help them work with San Luis Obispo County to establish specific action plans.
I think in this first phase, what we hope to achieve in conversations with Dr. Bornstein and her staff is just an acknowledgement, an agreement that what's being allowed at the state level can be allowed here in SLO County.
Immediate goals for the coalition include recording live performances with artists, live drive-in concerts, and later, live outdoor performances. Coalition member and director of Cal Poly Arts, Steve Larian, echoes that health remains front of mind.
Safety and protection of our artists, our audiences, et cetera, is number one priority. But we want to be treated equally with other industries. You know, it's just we're looking for fairness here more than anything.
For now, local arts groups are hosting virtual performances, but coalition members are optimistic that artists will be able to join each other on the stage soon. They say they're confident that the performing arts will find a way to keep going.
Back to the early days of the pandemic in Italy, when people were standing out on their balconies and singing arias just for their neighbors. You know, I mean, that's the kind of, that's what we represent. You know, we represent hope.
Music and art is really what's keeping us all going during this difficult time. It's a fight worth fighting.
Reporting for KCBX News, I'm Rachel Showalter in San Luis Obispo.
The KCBX Arts Beat is made possible by a grant from the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. Pumpkin spice is everywhere. Many are looking forward to that Thanksgiving pumpkin pie. But there's one kind of pumpkin spice that is unique to the Central Coast. Coming up, pie and ice cream with Father Ian on Playing with Food.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food. I've always wanted a celebrity on my show, so I'm going to let Ellen DeGeneres introduce today's featured food.
Last week I mentioned something that always happens this time of year. Pumpkin spice is popping up everywhere. I don't know why, but there's pumpkin spice lattes, pumpkin spice candles, pumpkin spice air fresheners, and now they have taken it so far. This is ridiculous. This is a commercial. It's a brand new network called the Pumpkin Spice Channel.
You're watching the Pumpkin Spice Channel.
Of course, there isn't a pumpkin spice channel, but how Ellen imagines it, it could very well come to fruition someday. Ellen is right, pumpkin spice is everywhere. Personally, I have avoided all things pumpkin spice until now. But in order to branch out into the world, and I didn't branch out very far, I thought I'd start with the origins of pumpkin spice. Pumpkin pie. I met up with the pie maker at Slow Provisions. When I arrived, Shannon Siegel was stirring a pot on the stove. She was concentrating the pumpkin puree along with brown sugar. It takes about 35 minutes and makes her pumpkin pie unique. The cooking of the puree gives it a silkier texture. I arrived right at the most apropos moment. In her industrial kitchen with its refrigerators, freezers, fans, timers, and all the sounds of a successful enterprise.
Ginger, cinnamon, cloves, and the salt, and now I'm going to put in fresh nutmeg.
I noticed that you used ground cinnamon, ground ginger, ground cloves, but you used freshly grated nutmeg. Would you ever use freshly grated cinnamon or freshly ground cloves? And that was an interesting thing you said about the cinnamon. The cinnamon we have in the store doesn't have any flavor?
Well, I don't think it does. That's my opinion.
You're talking about the sticks.
The sticks. It's just a quality thing. If you're getting a good quality one, which I have never found a good quality one at any store, but online, you know, there's so much more options. They've got some great spice stores online. I would start there if you want to ground your own cinnamon.
And what about fresh ginger in a pumpkin pie? What would that be like?
You know, ginger is very wet. I think it'd be a different texture. You know, I would probably grate it with a microplane like I just did here for the nutmeg, and it'll give you a different consistency. And I would worry about too much water getting into the pie and making it soggy. So I personally wouldn't do that. So you have such a small amount of cloves in the recipe, but cloves are very strong.
Yeah.
So that's a possibility too. If people say, "Oh, I don't like pumpkin pie," maybe somebody got a little heavy-handed with the cloves because a little bit goes a long way. Yeah. And when they say a pinch, it's literally a pinch.
Would you ever use ground nutmeg?
Nutmeg is just so good, freshly ground, and when it sits, it loses flavor.
What are the spices again that are in there?
Okay, so we've got ginger, cinnamon, nutmeg, and cloves.
I'm realizing that this same combination of spices is used in the places where these spices come from. If you go deep into Latin American cuisine, and if you go into Indian cuisine, and if you go into African cuisine, you find this combination of spices with other spices added on there as well, and some cayenne in there to give it some kick. And what triggered me to think about that is what you said about the warmth. And I was going to ask you, where else do we use this spice combination? But we do if we get into that Tropic of Cancer line of cuisine.
That conversation about the spices got me thinking about the origins of pumpkin pie spice. These spices are not indigenous to North America. So is this a relatively new fad? It turns out that it's not. Add all spice to the mix, and holiday history is born.
As far back as 1796, the American cookbook by Amelia Simmons, American Cookery, included recipes for pumpkin puddings baked in a crust and similar to present-day pumpkin pies. The spice mix included mace, nutmeg, and ginger. The term pumpkin pie spice has been around since the 1890s, and who knows when the spice companies started making the commercially available mix. A common mix includes 18 parts ground cinnamon, 4 parts ground nutmeg, 4 parts ground ginger, 3 parts ground cloves, and 3 parts ground allspice. The pumpkin spice latte has been around since 2003. And thanks to Marketplace, we know that through 2018, the well-known company has sold more than 424 million pumpkin spice lattes since its 2003 introduction.
Humans associate food with experiences, and for 130 years, pumpkin spice has meant a lot.
What are the spices again that are in there?
Okay, so we've got ginger, cinnamon, nutmeg, and cloves.
So the spices are the important thing. Here we are at the original pumpkin spice, which is where it comes from, pumpkin pie, right? So do you think this spice combination says to us then it's the holidays? And so the earlier I can have my pumpkin spice latte, the earlier the holidays are coming.
That's what it means for me. I think otherwise it wouldn't sell spice. I like it just fine, but I don't usually have it until it's the holidays. It's taking me back in time, back to the holidays.
You know, those spices and those aromas and those flavors that we associate with happy times or holiday times, but the pumpkin spice has a warmth to it, I think. It's probably something. Yeah. It's like a little hug.
It's like a little hug. Oh. Later that day, I picked up a slice of the pumpkin pie and brought it home for a snack. It was delicious. I had never had a pumpkin pie that thick. It was about an inch or an inch and a quarter high. It was a velvety texture, yet the sort of firmness that you want in pumpkin pie. The crust was not only flaky, it was crisp, even at the bottom. Perfectly baked. And the spices? Well, that's what this was all about, right? You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, baking pumpkin pie with Slow Provisions baker Shannon. I don't want these spices in my coffee, my Irish liqueur, or my candles. I want pumpkin pie spices in pumpkin pie. But there might be one food that is pumpkin spiced that I might actually like as much as pumpkin pie. And here is where pumpkin spice is unique to the Central Coast.
My name is Alexis Negranti, and I am the founder and owner of Negranti Creamery, and we produce 100% sheep's milk ice cream. This November marks our 10-year anniversary of having the creamery. Sheep's milk is naturally very sweet and very nutty, so it makes a really, really beautiful ice cream on its own without having to add anything else into it.
I told you that it was unique. It's the only sheep's milk ice cream in the country. I got a tour of the ice cream making process and the lowdown on the seasonal treat.
Can I see how ice cream is made?
Absolutely, yeah, we can go inside.
Okay, great.
Okay, so this is the creamery. So we have here, this is the ice cream machine.
Okay, it's a very small ice cream machine.
Yeah, so we have two, and we are actually purchasing a continuous freezer, which can do 100 gallons an hour. This will do 20, and then we have two of those, so we can do about 40 gallons an hour right now. And they're both running about 5 days a week.
Okay, how many gallons a week do you make?
Anywhere between 600 and 800 finished product gallons. Okay, let me walk you through it. The milk arrives, and we put it into this pasteurizer. Okay. And so what's unique about our product is that we make our own base mix. So a lot of people will purchase a base mix, but we don't use any additives or fillers, so we make our own. And all that is in our base mix is sheep's milk and tapioca starch, which is from the cassava root. So it's very natural, and we use that as our thickener instead of using anything artificial. We pasteurize it, and then we let it cool back down, and then that is our base. From there, we take it out, and we will make the ice cream. So we'll blend in the cane sugar, any ingredients. You know, right now she's doing the maple pecan. So we have candied our own pecans in the ovens, and she's adding that in, any flavorings, etc. And then we mix that up and throw it into the machine, pull it out of the machine, and it goes straight into the freezer, which you can see is at negative 20. Yeah. We have another even larger freezer downstairs as well. Whenever we have new recipes, I'm always making those, collaborating with our production team. So the new recipes come from me, but the day-to-day, our production team takes care of.
How many different flavors do you have?
Well, it depends on the season. We have 16 flavors in the case. We have 8 different pint flavors. And then seasonally, we're rotating out new flavors all the time. We've made hundreds of different kinds of flavors. And also for weddings and the ice cream trucks, we do custom flavors. So I did a Thai wedding and they wanted Thai iced tea ice cream. So I made Thai iced tea ice cream. So we can just do it all.
Well, now that we're talking about flavors, let's talk about the flavor of the month.
Okay. This will be really loud. Or we can just go right here. This will be...
So now that we're talking about flavors, let's talk about the flavor of the month. And I see here labels, actually, that says pumpkin spices.
Yeah, so we just launched our Harvest Pumpkin, which our guests look forward to every single year. You know, I'm getting emails in August, like, is it coming out? Is it coming out? And so it is here. We use real pumpkin and our own spice blend.
You use all natural ingredients. I even see pumpkin right there.
Oh, yeah. We had to order that much.
Right. Okay. In my mind, because I'm not an industrial cooker, I was thinking, oh, gosh, they go buy their pumpkins and they... I don't know why I didn't think of that. But you do get canned pumpkin, right?
Yes. Yeah. And it's all natural, pure. Like, that's all that's in it. There's right. No additives. There's no coloring. It's just pure pumpkin.
Because I was thinking of real pumpkins, I'm like, how does she get consistency with that? Because I have worked with real pumpkins. When I lived in Britain, I couldn't get a can of pumpkin for pumpkin pie until probably 2013. And the only time they had pumpkins in the stores was Halloween. And so all of the Americans would get their pumpkins at Halloween. And then at the beginning of November, we would roast them and puree them and do all this kind of stuff. And then at Thanksgiving, make our pumpkin pies. It was a big ordeal. Uh-huh. Or you could pay... there was an American section at a high-end store called Selfridges where you could get a can of pumpkin for like $10.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, and that's what I discovered working with fresh pumpkin. It's very variable. It was like the fifth time I figured out to get the water out was to puree it, put it in the refrigerator in cheesecloth and get liquid out that way, then freeze it for a couple weeks. And then thaw it out again on cheesecloth because the freezing draws out more water. So that's what was going through my mind when you said, we use our own pumpkin. I was like, oh my gosh. So what are the spices? Or is it a secret blend?
We do the classic cinnamon. We do nutmeg and a little bit of ginger in allspice. And it's a really beautiful blend. We think it's pretty unique.
What's the creative process in terms of coming up with the right spice blend and the right amount of pumpkin to put in? Do you end up having to eat a lot of ice cream?
You know, I think because I've been doing it for 10 years, it comes naturally to me. It comes very easily to me. I've messed up a handful of recipes, but for the majority of the time, I can get it within the first couple tries. And I think that just comes with 10 years of doing it. I kind of have an idea of, okay, what's the sugar content? What profile do I want for this flavor? Do I want it to be super sweet? Do I want it to be a little bit less sweet? Are we adding berries that are going to be providing natural sugar? So I'll bring down the cane sugar, et cetera, et cetera. So that's okay. Just kind of how it goes. For the pumpkin, I even use a little bit of brown sugar, and that adds another layer of interest and depth to the pumpkin that you would actually find in a pumpkin pie.
Did you use your grandmother's spice mix recipe for her pumpkin pie or something like that, or did you just...
I wish. That sounds really nice. Nope. I used my, what can I put together and what smells good, what's going to taste good, what do I like? We don't put anything out that I personally don't love.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian talking to Alexis Negronti about pumpkin spice sheep's milk ice cream.
So can I try your ice cream?
Absolutely, yes.
So this is, what is this? This is the...
So right there is the spice mix that we use for the harvest pumpkin.
Okay, I'm going to smell it. Try to smell it. Smells like pumpkin pie. I'm not the biggest pumpkin spice fan.
Well, that's okay.
I'm actually, hang on, let me taste it. It is like frozen pumpkin pie.
Yep.
I'm like, oh my gosh, it tastes exactly, and I like pumpkin pie.
Oh, good.
So when I say I'm not the biggest pumpkin spice fan, the pumpkin spice latte from that big major worldwide coffee shop.
That probably doesn't even have pumpkin in it.
Probably doesn't have pumpkin in it. They released that while I was living in Britain. The first year, all the British people were like, Americans are disgusting. Why would you ever do that? Blah, blah, blah. The next year, it went to Britain, and everybody was eating pumpkin, drinking.
Their PSL.
So I come back the day after Thanksgiving at the grocery store in the reduced clear section, and there are about 6 or 8 different products that are pumpkin spice that really shouldn't be pumpkin spiced.
I can only imagine.
You know, there were nuts, there were drinks, there was coffee, pumpkin spice, like the beans like you could buy.
Oh, yes.
So pumpkin pie, harvest pumpkin ice cream. Absolutely excellent.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, some people get a little carried away on the pumpkin spice, but you know what? They can sell it. Good for them.
Yeah.
This unique seasonal treat was super delicious.
Sheep's milk is only 8% fat, whereas like gelato or traditional ice creams are going to be higher than that. Some traditional super premium ice creams are up to 16% fat. There's a market and appreciation for all different kinds of ice creams and gelatos, and they're all amazing. But for us, I didn't want a super high fat content, and that really allows the flavors to shine through, having the lower fat content. Everything just tastes super clean, and that's because there's not a ton of cream added or anything else. So sheep's milk is 8% fat, and the wonderful, magical thing about sheep's milk is that it's naturally homogenized. So the fat molecules are mixed into the milk. It doesn't separate, so it's naturally more creamy than any other milk, even though it has a lower fat content.
So what will Alexis be doing for the holidays? Will she bake a pie?
How does making ice cream influence your own eating at home, your menus at home? Like when you have a birthday celebration, when your child's birthday or whatever, is it always ice cream? Or, you know, when Thanksgiving comes around, will you have your pumpkin spice ice cream? Or how does that work?
Yes, especially if we're going to an event, if I don't bring ice cream, I'm pretty much not allowed in. So, yes.
Sadly, this Thanksgiving, I won't be able to go to my sister's and have her mother-in-law's pumpkin pie without pumpkin spices. I'll be sheltering at home with my cat, Smokey. I'm not going to buy an entire pumpkin pie just for the two of us, particularly since he won't eat any. But this pumpkin harvest ice cream would be the perfect substitute. Ellen DeGeneres may mock the pumpkin spice craze, as do I. But our beloved spice mix is deeply ingrained in the American cultural fabric and evokes holiday euphoria. Whether in a pie, a latte, ice cream, or believe it or not, almonds, we'll take that euphoria as early in the fall as possible. Its importance is captured perfectly by John Greenleaf Whittier in his 1850 poem, The Pumpkin.
Ah, on Thanks Day, when from east and from west, from north and from south comes the pilgrim and guest, when the grey-haired New Englander sees round his board the old broken links of affection restored, when the care-wearied man seeks his mother once more, and the warm matron smiles where the girl smiled before. What moistens the lip and what brightens the eye? What calls back the past like the rich pumpkin pie?
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. KCBX.org.